Hello, this is Robert Rick over at Body Learning, and my guest today is Imogen Ragone, an Alexander Technique teacher and website designer in Wilmington, Delaware. And this is going to be part two of a two-part podcast series titled Alexander Technique and the Scientific Method. In our previous podcast, and Imogen's going to interview me for this one as well. In our previous podcast, we talked about the question of did Alexander himself use the scientific method? And the answer was pretty much yeah. And in this interview, we're going to talk about how answer the question, perhaps, is the scientific method being used in Alexander Technique teaching today? And as I said, Imogen's going to interview me, so I'm going to turn it over to you, Imogen.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks
again
for doing this again.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for volunteering.
So let's just start very briefly, and I would really recommend that people listen to part one first, although this will be its own entity.
Right.
But very briefly, what is the Alexander technique and what is the scientific method?
Right. Well, the Alexander technique, I would define it as a way of learning how to use your physical structure, your structure in general, as efficiently as possible, given its what it is and what the forces that are operating on it are on planet Earth. So making the best use of your body, or your body-mind if you like, and making the best use of forces like gravity and support, atmospheric pressure, heat, light, etc.
Okay.
It's not about what you do particularly, it's about how you do whatever you've decided you want to do.
Exactly. And the scientific method?
Scientific method, well, we talked a bit about that in the previous podcast, and I'll just repeat this little dictionary definition that's pretty good, actually. A method of procedure that has characterized natural science since the 17th century, consisting in systematic observation, measurement, and experiment, and the formulation, testing, and modification of hypotheses. And it's something that I think a lot of people learn in high school science classes. It's an idealized version of what goes on in science, but it is as you said in the last podcast, it's kind of the gold standard of any scientific study.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to conform to that, and maybe some other things as well. So, and as I said, I think we agreed that Alexander was using it as best he could at the time.
More or less.
And the question then is, are Alexander teachers using it today, or are students taught how to use it?
Yeah, so maybe that's kind of two parts. Are teachers using it themselves, and are they using it in their teaching and enabling their students
to use it,
kind of experiment and use it for themselves?
Well, I should start by saying that, you know, Alexander died a long time ago, over 50 years ago, and most teachers today never met him. They were trained by people who may have been trained by people and so on several generations back. And over there are, of course, a lot more teachers today than there were when Alexander was alive. And there's really a huge variation from what I can see in how teachers teach. And to cite one extreme, which was the one I was initially exposed to as mm-hmm. a student. My teacher did very little talking during a lesson. His English was somewhat iffy, and it was I would say about 90 to 95%. Just he used his hands to get me into a better relationship with myself, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was remarkably effective in the sense that while I never for a long time I had no idea what he was doing, I didn't sense anything during a lesson. I certainly noticed things happening outside of lessons pretty much immediately, and they were mm-hmm. dramatic. And
But you weren't experimenting, right? You were.
There was nothing to experiment with.
There was no scientific method involved on your part.
No, the main thing I did was he did have some things that we were told to do. One was never to cross our legs again, ever, when sitting. Always sit on a hard surface. He had special boards for that. And wow. when you stood up or sat down, you would always tuck your chin down onto your chest so you wouldn't tighten your neck. And as a matter of fact, you can still see people. If you ride the subways of Toronto, you will occasionally see people doing this. Uh-huh. And it does look weird. And it was an interesting moment when I arrived on the training course I went to and demonstrated it to the group. Uh-huh. But that's all by the by. I mean, sure. Essentially, there was no explanation. I did once ask him about directions mm-hmm. because I'd read about them, and he said, oh, you know, that's for advanced people or whatever. So there was no self experimentation mm-hmm. of any kind. But
so that's the one extreme.
That's an extreme, and perhaps ultimately in reaction to that, you know, all these years later, we're talking like 40 plus years later, I've kind of moved to the opposite extreme where I do use my hands for in-person students, but sparingly, and I tend to very much use directions and to teach people how to experiment with them. And I think there's all sorts of stuff in the middle. I think a lot of teachers do talk about observation, and most teachers have mirrors in their teaching studios, mm-hmm. so they may ask a student to observe themselves in the mirror, perhaps while they're being given a lesson, so they can get some accurate feedback about what's going on. So that kind of moves a little into the objective, trying to be objective about what's happening arena. And I don't really know. I mean, I can't say what teachers use for themselves these days because I can't read their minds.
Sure.
My general sense is that most students many students, let's put it this way, are not actually empowered with a way to change themselves through thought.
Right.
Which is sad, I think.
To me, that's I love that, and I love that empowering sense of that.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't really have any of that until I got to England, and even then it was a little murky about what the thought should be, and there wasn't any real discussion of how to employ the thought. But before so I think there's a lot of variation, and go ahead.
I was just thinking that in terms of this scientific method, and this applies to Alexander himself, because he was, when he was studying himself and coming up with his method, mm-hmm. it was just him. So he was both investigating, and he was the person that was being investigated. So he was investigator and investigatee. And that applies to our students. If they were asking to experiment and sort of collect data, if you like, on what ways of thinking work and what don't, and mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. how, you know, that they are...
They're in a weird position in terms of experimenting.
So that's quite a challenge.
It's definitely a challenge, and that challenge may be one reason why some, maybe many, maybe most teachers have sort of given up on giving students experiments to use on their own, because there are some inherent difficulties. And I want to talk about that whole question that you just brought up, the scientific method, that idealized version that I read the definition of and that we talked about in the previous podcast, assumes that the person running the experiment, the scientist, is not him or herself part of the experiment.
Yeah.
You know, the ideal version, some guy sitting at a console and he's adjusting one parameter and then he's measuring the results through some electronic device, or if a chemist is mixing a certain proportion of this and that, and this is what happened, and it happens over and over again, and the chemist is not really, or the scientist is not really... is not part of the process he's measuring. I mean, he's adjusting things, but he's not influencing the atoms or the molecules and so on. Mm-hmm. The problem is there's an example that in some ways is a little unrelated to the dilemma of an Alexander student trying to experiment, but it is an interesting one, in that this idea of the neutral observer is totally missing these days in the field of studying subatomic particles. It turns out, and this is from the 30s actually, I think, that if you're measuring like where a subatomic particle is, and you get that down exactly, you have no idea of how fast it's moving. And if you know exactly how fast it's moving, you have no idea where it is, and various combinations. Now, none of this applies to kind of our real world experience, you know, when we're dealing with objects. But in that field, the physicist is part of the experiment. It just has to be factored in. And there is this famous thing called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is well established. It tells you exactly just how uncertain it's going to be. Okay. And it doesn't matter like for normal objects, but it matters big time for subatomic particles. So there's sort of one example where the classic scientific method seems to break down a bit. But I think when Alexander was conducting his experiments, and as I said, you know, he was confronted with dealing with three things at the same time. What he was thinking, what his thought was about what he was going to do, what it felt like he did, and then what he observed in the mirror. And as I said last time, he opted for the mirror as being the more accurate thing because it was unconditioned.
And I would agree, but still your interpretation of what you're seeing, isn't it?
Oh, it could be. You could misinterpret what you see. I mean, you have to learn how to see those kind of things. But I think he was fundamentally correct in saying, geez, you know, my feelings may not be telling me what's going on. And that's, of course, the situation that Alexander teachers on their own and students on their own are confronted with all the time. That they feel they're doing one thing, and often it's pretty obvious to the teacher. And if the teacher wants to trot out a mirror or a video recording, they can show the student that. Mm-hmm. And the students have the same reaction that Alexander did. What do I do with this? You know? So there are teachers who I think have kind of given up on encouraging their students to experiment because it is to experiment in this kind of classic scientific way because it's so tricky. But there have been some developments in recent years, and particularly in Alexander directing and directions, that make things a lot easier. And I'm thinking of things like, well, originally negative directions from Missy Vineyard and freedom directions from Jennifer Roy Kelly, and that are easy for a student to learn to do, potentially very easy for a student to learn to do, but but they need to be, I think, for a student, if they want to be able to test them, they have to be able, they can't walk around with mirrors everywhere or or, you know, be on camera 24/7.
Why not?
Well, I mean, you could be, but very few people are going to want to do that. So the question is, all right, so feelings, physical sensations are not necessarily accurate. That is, you may think something is one thing, but it might be something different. But on the other hand, there is something that most people are pretty good at detecting, which is differences in levels of tension or differences in, for example, if they're walking and they walk with one thought, they can hear the sound of their feet on the floor or feel the pressure of their feet on the ground. And then if they use a direction, they may notice that their feet are a little quieter and there's less pressure. They may notice they can sense a difference in a kind of a downward pull that suddenly seems to appear when they throw the direction away, you know, as they go back into their old habit. So I think you can take advantage.
There's a way for them to.
It's a way to get
collect a little bit of data.
Collect some data. And most people with a little training, and often very little training, like a minute's worth, are able to detect differences, and that can be taken advantage of by running little experiments where you use a direction, throw it away, bring it back. And the directions that we have now available to us are so easy to use, they're so simple and easy to use, that it's relatively easy for a lot of people to learn how to run these experiments in a pretty short period of time. Now, what they have to, there are obstacles. There's the obstacle of trying to think the direction with some sort of effort, right? There's the obstacle of thinking this is a crazy direction, and so that's what they're thinking about instead of the direction. There's the obstacle of they use a direction and things feel nice, and they immediately go to that nice feeling and want to replicate it. So there are definite traps. But they're pretty, I think by this point, a lot of teachers are pretty familiar with those traps and can talk their students through them. So for that, people doing that, I'd say that is kind of the scientific method being applied.
In a very simple, practical way.
And not only that, but because these new directions, especially freedom directions, but some of the negative directions too, like so-called paradoxical directions, are so easy to use that students start sharing them with their friends and family, and can even help their friends and family get through these little pitfalls that we just been talking about. So it's not just our students that can employ the scientific method, if you like, but their friends and family as well. So right. I think the possibility is there. I think there's still a lot of teachers who have kind of rely on hands-on work primarily as their way of teaching, but there are other options.
I mean, and the hands-on while you're with your teacher can provide another mirror, if you like.
Absolutely.
Another sort of, if you're doing the experimenting, that gives you another source of, data.
Absolutely. Yeah. That can be a sort of a, but that's not going to be real helpful when you're on your own.
Right. You're in that situation, it's an added form of data collection. I mean, it's many things, but that's one thing that it can help with.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that's the current state of things. I do think these new directions are gaining in popularity. So, excuse me, hopefully over time there'll be more.
For me, I just love some of these new ways of directing, but that's a whole other story. It occurs to me, it's a slight switch of direction in our discussion, but I'm thinking of the Alexander technique as a whole, and has the scientific method been used to verify, for instance, the usefulness of the Alexander technique in various situations or applications?
Yes, and the answer is a resounding yes, and is historically, I'll be really brief about this. As far as I know, the first sort of semi-scientific investigation was done by Wilfred Barlow, when he was measuring the lengths of people's necks.
Right.
About it. But more probably better known by a lot of people, the work of Frank Pierce Jones, using strobe photography to observe people as they, I think he was, a lot of it was getting in and out of a chair before and after hands-on work, that sort of thing. And of course, since then, a lot of stuff, maybe the most famous, the UK National Health Service back pain study, which was pretty solid evidence that the technique can help with that, and lots of other studies that have been coming out over the last 10 years or so. And I'd like to especially mention the work of a neuroscientist and Alexander technique teacher, Tim, I think his last name is
Cacciatore,
who's an American. His PhD in neuroscience, but he is on the, he's at the University of London, and he's run heaven knows how many experiments now, at least half a dozen, I think more, in which he's actually measuring postural tone and how Alexander lessons affect that. I should say most of the scientific study, almost all of the scientific studies apart from his, are measuring things based on interviews with the people who were having lessons. You know, was your back pain better after lessons? That sort of thing. But what Tim has done, he's measuring an actual thing directly, and using a really interesting piece of equipment. And you know, that's like very really precise measurements that are not, don't rely on an individual self-reported
so it's removing even further from the investigatee having anything to say about it.
Right, the investigatee is just puts himself in this machine and gets twisted around in a certain way, and it's measured. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I think his work deserves a lot more attention than it's got. I think it's the most important research in our field in some ways. So the answer is, generally speaking, scientific studies confirm that the Alexander technique is useful for different things, you know, depending on the study. Yeah. And
wasn't there a study, I wish I had the information at my fingertips, wasn't there a study done quite recently that actually somehow was measuring, it might have been postural tone or the way, it might have been the way people were walking, but when actually thinking different things. So yes. It was actually really kind of relating to what we were talking about and directing.
Right. It wasn't measuring. So most of the experiments, you know, there'll be some people who don't get lessons and some people who get some other modality and some people who get Alexander lessons, and then you ask them questions afterwards about how things went, you know, maybe a month after or 2 months after. But this one you're talking about is people actually self-directing in the moment.
Yes.
And it affecting. Yeah. And which is a really, really interesting study. And there's also one that just came out a couple of days ago about neck tension done at the University of Idaho, I think, by Rajal, is that how it's
pronounced? Cohen.
Rajal
yeah,
Cohen,
yeah.
yeah.
Cohen.
So,
okay,
I mean, yeah. And that's like Tim Cacciatore's in that it's not, I don't think she actually asked people stuff, she just measured stuff.
Yeah,
So the answer is yeah. The scientific method has been used repeatedly, and especially over the last 10, 12 years. I mean, it's and the number of studies keeps growing. Pretty definite confirmation that this work, in whatever variety the students got it, you know, they got different teachers have, as I said, have different ways of teaching. So, but it does seem as though the Alexander technique is pretty definitely a useful and effective process. So that's a nice thing.
It is a nice thing, and it's nice that it's not just me knowing it in myself.
Right.
There's
right.
actually other data to prove it. So is there anything else you want to share on this subject?
No, I think I've said everything I wanted to say.
I had one thought just in relation to our discussion on effective ways of thinking and directing, in that you and I will be actually doing a workshop on that subject at the upcoming International Congress in Chicago.
Yes, we will.
So if you're interested,
empowering your students. I think the title is something like empowering your students.
Think for themselves or think effectively.
I really do believe that with this new, you could call it self-directing technology, people can learn stuff incredibly fast that they can use themselves. I mean, like shockingly fast. And it's such a different process than I went through originally as a student for when I first encountered the technique. So, okay, well, I will want to thank Imogen Ragone for volunteering to interview me for this podcast.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And she's a teacher, Alexander teacher, website designer in Wilmington, Delaware. I'll be putting a link to her site by the interview. Also a site, a page that it's all about scientific and experiment. Summarizes all the literature on scientific experiments about the technique and medical endorsements as well, and also a link to a site that'll tell you generally more about the technique and how to find a teacher. So Imogen, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.